from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sear, Doug Ibendahl, and Georgia Logothites. Our program tonight, coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And again, you can join us on the World Wide Web audio and video each and every Sunday night, as well as anytime, 24 hours of the day, 365 days a year at BeyondTheBeltway.com. Keep that in mind. If you missed the show, you can always find it on our website. We have lots to talk about. Last week, the second full week of the Trump presidency, was as busy as the first one, maybe even a little more controversial, and we have lots to talk about it this evening. And I want to begin with Georgia Logothites, who's a frequent guest on this program. She's a progressive. She's a contributing editor to the Daily Kos. And I want to begin with asking everyone about the issue of resistance. Those who did not vote for Donald Trump, and they voted for Hillary Clinton or someone else, or Americans that didn't vote at all, 42% of eligible voters didn't vote at all. So they have no skin in the game here. But what is the role of the resistance going to be for the next 4 years to Donald Trump? Are you going to resist everything, or are you going to pick and choose your fights?
Well, I think that the role of the resistance is to hold Donald Trump accountable, because we know that, you know, the executive branch is not going to hold him accountable, other members of the executive branch. We saw how he fired the attorney general, the acting attorney general, who disagreed with his order, within obviously his purview as president. But that's part and parcel of what his MO is. If people don't agree with him, he tells them you're fired. So we know there won't be any type of pushback from the executive branch. With respect to the Congress, we know there won't be a lot of pushback. We've already seen Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell say that, you know, they're on board with a lot of Donald Trump's agenda.
But there is McCain, there is Graham, there is Ben Sasse.
Yeah, but even let's take Rubio, who was so forceful. I mean, when we saw Senator Rubio at the hearing questioning Rex Tillerson about Russia, everybody thought it was a moment of courage, and everybody thought that Senator Rubio would vote against him and be part of that kind of core of the Republican Party that would hold Donald Trump accountable. And he didn't. He ended up voting against him. So, and then we see Donald Trump attacking the judicial branch. So I think what you see in terms of the resistance, as it's called, you know, it's a mishmash of various groups. Everybody's kind of clamoring for something different. Some are fighting for climate change. Some are fighting for, you know, right to privacy and choice. Other people are constitutionalists. You're seeing all of these diverse groups come together because they know that this is not normal.
Okay. Now, Doug Ibendahl, you're our card-carrying Trumpster. You were for Donald Trump long before it was fashionable, predicted his presidency long time ago. So let me ask the question to you this way. Obviously, you're not pleased with the level of resistance that's out there at the moment. But look back 8 years ago. What was the resistance that started immediately after Barack Obama was elected president?
Are you talking about the Tea Party movement?
No. Yeah. I mean, it took a few years, but right. It didn't happen instantly.
Right. But what we're seeing now is different. I mean, this is beyond – I don't know what resistance means. I mean, at some – very quickly it's going to become these so-called resistors are going to be seen as, if they're not already, it's already a movement that way, that these folks are going to be seen as – what are they resisting exactly? They're resisting Donald Trump rebuilding this country and putting people back to work, rebuilding this country, rebuilding our military, and creating jobs and opportunity in the inner cities, as he's promised to do, and making this country safer. The Democratic Party today is decimated. It's been decimated under President Obama. The Democratic Party today has the fewest elected officials since 1920. That's including, you know, the state legislatures up through Congress.
So you were not, are you not worried about the demonstrators in the street, which appears to be almost a weekly occurrence?
Well, I'm worried about the personal safety of, as the people that these thugs and these hooligans are attacking.
I have to pop in, Bruce.
Wait. It's well documented. I mean, we've got the left out there resisting against something. It's very vague. Meanwhile, they're engaged in the left wing, the radical left. Is engaged in brown shirt tactics on the streets of America. And you know what? My point was, after the decimation of the Democratic Party, I mean, they're not even a national party anymore. They're a regional party.
Doug, you made your point. I want to engage Art Sir, who joins us tonight from Carthage College. Nice to have you with us, Art.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
In the broader historical context, elections are held. The losing side licks their wounds, and they generally come together, and there's peace that follows, and we celebrate this peaceful transition. There hasn't been that peaceful transition, at least in the body politic. Are you worried about that?
Not particularly. Our politics has always been very conflictual. I was around in the 1960s, which was the one time in my life that I thought our country was coming apart despite a strong economy. And Bruce Dumont in the Illinois National Guard was in Chicago in 68 during the terrible convention. Well, thank you for your good service.
The West Side was not lost.
Yeah. We live in a very acrimonious time. I actually think President Obama handled the transition very appropriately and set the right example. We'll see how he does now that he's out of office. But to me, that was in line with the best traditions of the U.S.
Georgia, you took exception to Doug.
I did, because, I mean, we've been hearing this for a while, right? Ever since the election, when people, you know, stood up and took to the streets and had a post-inauguration protest that was record turnout. Everyone's called them thugs and brown shirts and violence, and there was nobody arrested as part of the millions of people who are turned on in D.C. But I want people to underestimate us. I want the right to think that we're just a flash in the pan or something like that, because I can tell you I've been organizing since the election, and there are people coming out in wheelchairs, senior citizens. There are people that were in Japanese internment camps. There are disabled people coming out. They're not thugs and brown shirts. They're Americans that love their country and want to take
action. But some of them are.
Georgia, let me ask you this.
They're rioting.
I want to follow. How do you separate, because you're a very keen observer of the media, how do you observe the video? You say no one was arrested in Washington. I don't think that's true, because I think some of those that were doing property damage in Washington were arrested. It was a relatively small number. Mm-hmm. But when you
on the inauguration, yes.
Inauguration day. So when you see that, or when you see what happened at Berkeley this past week, that can't make you happy, because you're not gaining supporters.
Of course not. And look,
how does that get rooted out by the left, by the progressives who believe as you do? I don't think you want violence.
Of course not. Yeah.
But how do you stop violence when there's people within your midst who are off the reservation?
Well, I don't.
As may be the case. Sometimes when there's right of center groups.
And that's the thing. I think that in any political movement, right or left, right, you do have these extremist elements. On the left, you have firebrands, anarchists. There's this group called the Black Bloc, and they go dressed like ninjas, you know. And we have to stand up and say no to the violence. We can accomplish change.
But why aren't Democratic leaders doing that? I don't see them doing that.
They are absolutely.
They're encouraging it.
Who is doing it?
You can see on Twitter. You can see on Twitter the Democratic leadership has stood up against it. They're certainly not encouraging.
I think that's very disingenuous. I do see them encouraging violence.
I want to get your reaction to that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, we have a long list of things to talk about. We've just begun to pick the scab off tonight. Back shortly.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont, back in Chicago, we were discussing how those on the left, or it also being the right, but in this particular case, most of the protesters are from the progressive wings of American politics. And yet there was violence. There was a significant violence and destruction of property at the University of California. Mm-hmm. Realistically, how do you control that, Georgia? I mean, you said that people have to speak out against it, and maybe they send a tweet. But that any denunciation of that conduct by elected officials, whether they're even if presidents, former presidents, Hillary, whatever it is. And by the way, I don't think the people that were in Berkeley were not Hillary Clinton's supporters. I don't
Agreed.
Believe. I think they were anarchists.
Anarchists.
So how do you separate them out? And I want to get Doug, whether Doug would agree with that, because that could exist on the right as well. It hasn't, but it does.
You point out the fact that they're anarchists. They're going to riot and destroy property and do other illegal acts, regardless of whether Democratic Party leaders or leaders of the progressive movement tell them no. In fact, that will embolden them to do it even more, right?
But do leaders of the left mm-hmm. who are out there protesting legitimately mm-hmm. they may be picking up things or plans, or they may be the best intelligence, frankly, to report to law enforcement what the anarchists well, yeah. are
and,
about
and
to
you've
do.
Seen, and you've seen, you can go on YouTube and search videos when people, you know, there was, the punching of the Nazi, so to speak, and everybody right away went after the guy who punched him.
Right.
I mean, there's videos out there that show that the protesters don't want to be tainted with that association. Nobody wants to. It hurts the movement. Now, whether they can control it, like, as you mentioned, they're anarchists.
To what extent are the street demonstrations, to what extent are they funded by George Soros?
Zero. My check is not in the mail, I guess. These are absolutely organic. I mean, I can tell you again, I've been organizing since the election with a group called Action for Better Tomorrow. It is absolutely organic. I am not getting people who are being
but that's you, but you can't speak for you can't speak for George
organic,
Soros.
You know, and this and I love that George Soros is always the boogeyman. I mean, you know, there's very valid reasons obviously to criticize him.
As well as the Koch brothers.
Every time that there's a protest, every time something bad happens, Soros is cutting the check. Soros is cutting the check. Where's your proof?
Well, look, this is nothing new. There is undisputed proof that the radical wing of the Democratic Party, which is really about the only wing, really is the only wing left of the Democratic Party, has been inciting violence. What happened at UC Berkeley was nothing new. Bruce, you and I saw it firsthand. We were in the riot at UIC when Trump came here right before the primary in March
Bob,
of last
and Bob
year.
Bob Creamer, a paid operative.
Bob Creamer on tape, paying people, talking about paying people to incite violence at Trump rallies. This is nothing new. And you know what? A lot of people thought that, you know, given how badly the Democrats lost, given that they are no longer a national party, there really are no blue states anymore. What we've got in America are red states and then a tiny, tiny handful of what I would call brown shirt states, where what's left of the Democratic Party is they are so angry. And they were told by the corrupt media that Donald Trump was going to lose, that their person was going to win. They cannot handle it. All they've got left is violence. As a Republican, my biggest fear was they would get their act together.
All right, wait.
But they're not doing that.
But again,
so it's fine.
Doug, we're only 2 weeks into the administration. So they can get their act together. But I want to look at some other broader issues and go beyond just the temperature here. Obviously, for the last week, the big focus has been on the president's immigration policies and the travel ban. He swears it is not a Muslim ban, but the media continues to reference a Muslim ban. In your view, Art, looking at the specifics that you know about the travel ban, what do you see the president trying to do?
I think it's a political gesture directed toward his base. He's also doing what he said he was going to do in this area and others. It's faced immediate legal challenges, and that's ultimately the source of strength in our system.
Is it wise
law?
Do you think it's a good idea for a political leader to secure his base first?
I'm not a politician. I'm a professor. I think normally a president will reach out to try to find some consensus with other groups. That's still, I believe, the way our system works best. That has not been the case with this president, dramatized and symbolized by his inaugural address.
But I also don't think, my recollection going back to 2008, Barack Obama came out with 19 executive orders. Mm-hmm. He did things that solidify his base. It seems to me that politics 101, whether it's Barack Obama or Donald Trump, the first thing you do is you deal with your base. You give your base something that excites them, because once they're happy, then you can wander off a little bit. You can do some other things. But it's to me, it's political suicide for anyone initially to say, you know, do something for those that lost the election, especially when it was so vicious.
I mean,
Georgia,
the issue is
you're not expecting him to do anything for your causes.
Oh,
right away,
absolutely not. I mean, there was nothing in the campaign that suggested that he would govern, in a consensus way.
Even though last week, one thing he didn't do, didn't get a lot of publicity, he did not sign an executive order dealing with LGBTQ.
He didn't sign the one that was circulating. Absolutely, allegedly.
And everybody was expecting
because his daughter said not to sign it. But apparently there's another one coming down the pike, rumors, you know, about how that's going to happen.
But does he get credit for that?
I mean, do you give somebody credit for doing the right thing? I give him credit for not stripping rights.
Yeah,
I mean,
I guess the
fact that he always has, you know, such a low expectation of what he's supposed to do as president, you know, I don't think
it's
fair.
By you, but not by the people who won.
Going back to the executive orders, I think one thing is his approval numbers, as we've seen, are the lowest of any incoming president ever. He's losing parts of his base, and I think people feel like they were sold a bill of goods.
Hang on
just a second. You talked about him losing his base. Let's go to a man who's part of the base, and let me ask you your assessment of what are you hearing from your friends.
Oh my gosh, all my friends. I don't know a single Trump supporter who's losing faith. For the people who won this election, that was 65 million people who voted for Donald Trump, whatever it was, huge landslide win nationwide. Every morning is Christmas morning now. We jump out of bed, you know, watching this president make America better. This president has done more in 2 weeks than, you know, good for this country than Barack Obama did in 8 years.
Doug, let me ask you this, though. And I realize you're a huge supporter and you like the policy. Would you acknowledge that the rollout of the immigration reform plan and could have been handled a little more adeptly?
It's we're talking about the government here.
Yes.
Nothing is going to go smoothly. Also,
we're not just talking about the government, because at this particular time, it really is only the White House.
It was the
White House execution of this plan that has been criticized. Now, it's been criticized by those that voted against him because they don't like the plan. But what I'm talking about is someone who's always given Donald Trump, I think, a fair show here. Can you acknowledge, as someone who really loves Donald Trump, can you acknowledge that could have been handled a little more adept, a little more professionally?
Do any of us do anything in our jobs during the day where, you know, later, I should have said this or this.
Doug, then the answer to the question is yes.
There's
Bruce,
always something better you can better. Do. But I mean, okay. for crying out loud, we've got people running into federal court because they were delayed, you know, 3 or 4 hours at the airport. If you go to a post office in this country, you're probably talking about a 1 or 2 hour commitment to mail a package. I mean, come on.
Are you kidding? I mean, seriously. Are you kidding? Wait. And this is part and parcel of what Donald Trump does when he initially said only 109 people were affected by it, and it turned out to be almost 100,000. What's lost on the right is the fact that these are people that are fleeing war. When you deny a refugee entry into the United States, that means you're trapping them in a war zone. And because we don't have, you know, a sound Syria policy, and I'll absolutely criticize President Obama on that, absolutely, and other world leaders that have not done their part to address the Syrian humanitarian crisis, you are essentially, you know, putting them at risk for death. So it's not that they're going to court for an inconvenience. They're going to court for their lives.
Oh, for crying out loud! You know, this is how desperate the left is now that they've lost their base. I mean, working people, blue collar workers, union workers, they've lost those. It looks like they're.
But I mean,
they're,
can you deny like the fact like that big Syrian interest, refugees are fleeing
their big
war?
Interest now is to bring in like Al Qaeda. That's their future base.
I want to come back. You have made the point. You've made that point several times already tonight. So I want to go back to where you are an expert. You are an expert on the base. So I'm asking you, Georgia said there's some in the base that are worried about Donald Trump. Frankly, I disagree with that. Are there issues out there where you think Donald Trump maybe is not infuriated? He hasn't infuriated anybody who voted for him. But are there people out there, and I'm going to ask everybody listening on the radio and watching on television, has Donald Trump, if you vote, and let's be honest, if you voted for Donald Trump, and really be honest now, if you voted for Donald Trump, is there anything he's done thus far that upsets you?
Honestly, Bruce, there's not. I could not be happier. What I think has the media and the left so like shocked and outraged is that, oh my gosh, you mean a politician can actually, a candidate can actually follow through and do the stuff
but he's not
he said he was going to do?
On some
it
of his
is
promises.
Unbelievable.
Big ones,
and
the big ones he is.
And you know, I'm just not some, you know, rubber stamp Republican, Bruce, as you well know. Yeah. No one has been more critical of Republicans. I would put my credentials, my Republican criticizing credentials against Georgia's any day. If I'm saying there's a Republican out there, which I am, Donald Trump, who's the real deal and is a real leader and knows what he's doing, I think I've got more credibility on that.
Okay. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, callers on the line, we will bring them into the conversation from Washington to New Jersey.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back. We will go to calls in just a moment, but I do want to bring in Art Sear from Carthage College, who, since foreign policy is your area of expertise, your reaction to the new Secretary of State who was sworn in this week.
I think it's very interesting. I think it shows that hostility to big business, which became very powerful in this country during the Great Depression and continued through the 60s and was last really reflected in the Kennedy administration, that's faded quite completely. I think it's an imaginative choice. I do think that Russia and the U.S. have interests that overlap significantly, not just, but in particular in the Middle East. And in that sense, there's an opportunity for some really not only fresh perspectives, but perhaps fresh policies.
One of the things that the president said this past week is he acknowledged the difference of opinion on waterboarding between how he felt about waterboarding and how General Mattis felt about it, his defense secretary, and said that he was going to defer to General Mattis, even though he said, personally, I'm for waterboarding. Do you think there's going to be other examples when you bring somebody in like Rex Tillerson, who he obviously has a great deal of respect for? Are the cabinet secretaries, at least the strong ones, like Tillerson, are they going to be able to convince the president to look at things a different way?
We'll see. I think that's a good question. Given Trump's inexperience in foreign affairs and in government, I think there's an opportunity for a more collegial cabinet system to work. Mattis is a very, very impressive leader to me. I think perhaps because President Trump does not have a strong base within the Republican Party, especially the establishment, I have the sense that he's developing alliances with the military as a way of
what is your general impression of the cabinet positions approved thus far?
I think they're uneven. Education and Treasury, I think, leave a lot to be desired. And the new nominated Education Secretary DeVos may not be confirmed. I think other people are very good. In response to your torture question, Mattis said very specifically, much more effective is sharing a pack of cigarettes and a six-pack of beer, which is the voice of experience, which is more and more important in Washington today.
Okay.
Thank you for asking me to participate.
Here's my question, Doug. Can the base, speaking for the base now, can the base accept a pullback from some positions taken in the campaign when the president would say, you know, I still feel this way, but I'm listening to my experts, and they have a difference of opinion, and I've hired them to run the Defense Department or the State Department, and I'm going to defer to them. Can he get away with that from the base?
I think so. I think absolutely so. I was certainly counsel Saul. I think that there'll be a few outliers, of course, but I think a true Trump supporter appreciates and knows what Donald Trump went through to get here. I mean, so many people, so many, powerful elements of this country, the media, the Democrats, the old dinosaur wing of the Republican Party. I mean, he went through so much, overcame so much, and the guy is a fighter. And I think 99.9% of Trump supporters, voters trust him. Absolutely.
I saw something interesting on Fareed Zakaria today. Stephen Hadley was on, former national security advisor in the Bush administration, George Bush administration. And I was surprised that as an old guard establishment Republican foreign policy guy, he came down fairly soft or positive for Trump and what Trump has done so far. That may be the break of the break in the armor, at least for the resistance.
I'm not worried about the real Trump supporter. The ones that'll be an annoyance, an irritant, will be the jealous ones,
McCain,
Lindsey Graham,
and maybe Rubio.
Yeah, and then like our governor here in Illinois, and right. Congressman Adam Kinzinger. Yeah. These people are looking for something. They're very jealous and resentful of Trump's success, his huge crowds. They'll be trying to nitpick whenever they can.
Let's go, and again, we're not going to get into crowd size. Let's go to Spokane, Washington, where Mike is listening to us on KXLY, one of our oldest affiliates from the Great Pacific Northwest. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. And first of all, I got to say it's the home of Gonzaga University Bulldogs, number one
yes.
in the country at Jesuit School.
The boyhood home of the college home of Bing Crosby.
That's right. Many people don't realize he grew up here in Spokane.
I do.
Actually, we're not far from his house here in Gonzaga. But, thank you, Bruce. The hatred and sometimes violence by many who oppose President Trump is alarming. There's possibly more hatred now than during the Civil War. And opposition political leaders need to take the lead and say enough's enough. Ask for calming. So views can be expressed in a calm atmosphere.
Georgia, what's your reaction to that?
I think people have a selective memory. I think that if you go on the internet, you'll see that when President Obama was elected, they were burning effigies of him and lynching mannequins that look like him from trees. So let's not pretend and be all naive and think that this political climate is something that, just came out of an anti-Trump opposition.
Were those more restricted situations, though? I mean, there weren't thousands of people in the street.
There were definitely protests against Barack Obama. Now, granted, they weren't violent. I'll agree,
right.
like knocking down, burning limos and stuff like that. Well, you bring up a good point. There are the violent protests, which are going to be sporadic. We hope and pray to God that these anarchists are quickly, taken care of and arrested and everything like that. Now, in terms of these other protests, the peaceful protests, the protests of the resistance, so to speak, you will see them out on a weekend basis for sure. You will see them track their congressmen at town halls. Absolutely. It's going to happen on a weekly basis.
And it's happened in Chicago recently.
It absolutely happened in Chicago. Peter Roskam.
California.
Yeah. Peter Roskam had a closed-door GOP event out in the 6th District, and he didn't think that three protesters would show up. And there were, hundreds. I think the last count was 500 that was put out by the news stations. And these people, if they're going to get up in Palatine at 7 in the morning in the freezing cold to go and protest their congressman. I guarantee you, when the weather gets better, the crowds are going to get bigger.
What are they protesting exactly? Are Donald Trump's creating too many jobs and too much opportunity?
What jobs has he created? What jobs has he created? He's been in office 2 weeks.
Exactly. You ask a good question. What are they protesting?
Absolutely. Well, with respect to the congressman, I know Peter Raskman, a lot of people are very upset with his record. And it's very anti-worker. It's very anti-choice. And so there's a lot of reasons why people are protesting him. With respect to Donald Trump.
But he gets reelected every 2 years.
Well, and that's why, because, you know, you have these politicians. There's an incumbency rule for a reason. You know, and those of us that have worked on political campaigns know it's extremely hard once somebody wins their first race to field a candidate that will have enough money and enough resources to hold them accountable. I think that's going to change.
So does the Tea Party movement represent the political template that the resistance on the left wants to follow in the congressional elections in 2 years? Is that, as you say, showing up at a congressman's office, forcing him to get police protection, as was the case with a congressman in California? Are you taking the message from the streets right to the congressional office?
Yeah, I mean the Tea Party movement was able to get, you know, national media attention,
yes,
and the attention of members of Congress precisely because they showed up. And I think that's absolutely the template that people are following.
And as part of the template, frequently, they were yelling in the faces of the elected officials.
Absolutely, I've seen that before. Yelling, and it's
not that what happened with the Tea Party. We're not talking about riots. They weren't burning Berkeley, but would you acknowledge that part of the success or the intimidation of the Tea Party movement was it was a face to face, almost hand to hand combat with members of establishment members, Republicans.
Right, congressmen would come home and they would go to a town hall. I never really
and they'd be shouted down.
I never really called myself a Tea Partier.
Talk about the tactic, though.
Right, congressmen just want to sit and be told that they're great, and so when they show up, you know that they're wonderful. So when they show up at a town hall and there are constituents there,
so
say you're not so great.
So as a political operative, would you acknowledge then that the tactics used by the Tea Party could be replicated by the political left? Maybe with the same input.
I'm all about holding politicians accountable, and a lot of the very few politicians have been accountable in this country. That's what's different about Trump, and that's where this so-called resistance movement is going to have a big problem. When economic growth hits 3%, which I think is very likely this year, and jobs and opportunity are being created all over the country, we're putting people back to work. We're undoing all this damage that the incompetence and corruption of, you know, the Democrats have done. Then this resistance is going to look like even more sour grapes than it is today.
You hope so, but my question to you, Art, if the progressive left, with all of the groups, there's a variety of groups that are involved in it, whether they're coordinated or not, we can argue that. You could deny it. You could make the charge. We don't know specifically. But the one thing that – one common denominator is they're going to resist Donald Trump. So my question to you is, if you look at the – in the congressional races that are coming up, mm-hmm, if they are unsuccessful, are they – inadvertently pushing the Democratic Party to a position that makes the Democratic Party less attractive to the general public? In other words, the Democrats that walked away in this election, are they going to stay away, or are they going to be moved because of the opposition that's out there at the particular moment?
It depends on leadership. In both parties, the Democrats are really, in a fundamental way, kind of leaderless now. The Clintons are gone after many years. They had such internal power that it was demonstrably true, except for Bernie Sanders, who was an oddball candidate. There was no way of denying Hillary Clinton the nomination. What we need is someone to emerge from the disorder, and that hasn't yet happened. Secondly, the off-year elections will be telling. Barack Obama was remarkably successful at the presidential level, but in 2010 and 2014, Democrats lost big. And the true test of President Trump's national leadership will be the off-year election.
That's true, and presidents typically lose seats in a midterm.
But not as much as Obama.
It's going to be different.
When we come back, I'm going to ask Georgia, who is her pick to head the Democratic National Party?
That's a good question.
And your phone calls.
That's a good question.
My name is... Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, John.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and
a historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us tonight. I asked Georgia before the break who she is going to support or whether she has a player in the game or the head of the DNC.
Yeah,
who do you think?
No candidate yet. You know, I think it's like you mentioned, the Democratic Party is leaderless right now.
Thank you.
And a lot of people are trying to, you know, claim the mantle, but they don't really have a strategy. And, you know, President Obama admitted in an interview after the election that he kind of dropped the ball in building up the Democratic Party, right? I mean, you pointed out
big time.
You know, the Republicans control the governor seats in the country, the state legislatures, everything. And then people complain about policy, but that's a different issue. But I would have loved to have seen Joe Biden step up. I think that would have been a remarkable role for him. He has incredible support among the Democratic base.
Is it too late?
I don't think, well,
it's never too late.
It's never too late, but I think, you know, he already endorsed, I believe, was it Tom Perez? He already endorsed him. But I think that it was a missed opportunity to court him for the position.
Do you, at this moment in time in the history of the wake of what happened last November, is it more important to sort of galvanize the progressive Bernie Sanders wing of the party? Is that more important than reaching back and trying to get some of the blue collar Democrats who went with Donald Trump? If you have to focus on one, mm-hmm. I know you want both, but where do you put your focus right now?
I think the focus should just be on working. I mean, if you look at the Illinois Democratic Party, right? I mean, it's basically non-functional. If you look at other state Democratic parties, they're not functional. And I think it's left. I think it's less about how progressive the party becomes and basically just functioning as a national party again. When people want to run for local office and they reach out to their Democratic Party, right, it's not like they get a ton of assistance.
Right. Let's go to Jim in Portland, Oregon, listening to us on KUFO. Nice to hear from Oregon tonight. Go ahead.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for taking my call again.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted to respond, you know, to your comment earlier about Trump supporters. You know, is there anything he can do to lose us?
Yeah.
And I can tell you, Bruce, I've supported Donald Trump basically from when he announced. I've called in your show several times.
Yes.
And you know what? The people that support Donald Trump are supporting him for immigration reform, turning the economy around, and his Supreme Court nomination. And he has nailed every one of those.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything that he's done so far that's going to cause my support is strengthened, not weakened. And I think these anarchist protests that we're seeing in New York and in Berkeley, I think are making Donald Trump stronger. He's gathering more and more support because of that. And I think if you look at, you know, you've been talking about the progressive answer to the Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party arose and pushed the Republican Party more than anything else.
Yes.
You know, we picked up, you know, Rubio and Cruz and some slam dunk conservative Republicans on the left. The Democrats are already about as far left as you can get. So what is their base going to do? I mean, I don't.
Well, I think, Jim, this is where I might disagree with you. And I think Georgia might agree with me as well. And she might believe that the Democratic Party isn't left enough. So what we have here is the most vociferous, the most dedicated voters that went to the polls last year. They were Trump supporters. The second, or very close to that same level of veracity, or velocity and veracity, were the Sanders supporters, and they're the ones that, you know, they're licking their wounds. They're not happy now. They might be happy when President came out against a TPP, but you know, on most issues they're going to be opposing Donald Trump, and that's where the energy in the party, that's where the youth in the party is, that's where the energy in the party is. And what I'm just saying is, as the Democratic Party looks to sort of rebuild itself, It seems to me they've got to focus. They got to choose which direction are they going to go, because I don't think they can be all things to all people. They need a message that really rallies people. And on some of these issues, those wings of the Democratic Party are on opposite sides.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, Bruce. I just don't think they have a message that's going to appeal to the core consistency out there.
Okay, well, we're going to find out, because as Georgia said, they've got to do something. They're organizing. Remember 8 months ago we were going to talk about the death of the Republican Party and how Donald Trump was destroying the Republican Party? Remember when that was the big story out of D.C. every single week on the Sunday shows? Well, not so much. Art Sears got a comment.
Yeah, we were fortunate to have Bernie Sanders speak at Carthage College, and he did win the Wisconsin primary, an early indication of the weakness of Clinton's candidacy. We had a huge crowd. Lots of students were there and some faculty, but it was working people. Mm-hmm. I got there quite early. I was writing about it, and they had two lines around our athletic track, and they literally disappeared over the horizon, working people of all ages, not just older people. These are people traditionally associated with the Democratic Party, starting with Eisenhower, that began to change, and then with Reagan, it really changed. But working people appeal to the American worker, not the full-time activist, and certainly not the intellectual activist.
We're going to move to Bonnie in Northwest Indiana. She's listening to us online tonight. Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hello. Okay, so here's my thought, and it's the thought of a lot of other people, too. Hillary Clinton, what she did when she exposed her emails intentionally by not securing them to foreign operatives, potentially getting our, you know, people who help us in foreign countries and spy for us, exposing those people, she put them at risk, and she caused potential damage to the United States. I feel that there is a, you know, you could make a case and call that treason. We have a man who is in jail right now, a military person, who took a photo of himself inside of a ship and put it on his desk. And for that, he's serving 3 years in prison. And she gets to skate away. And there are a lot of people who feel she should be indicted.
Bonnie, I agree with you. There's a lot of people who feel that way. You are certainly making your case against Hillary Clinton. A lot of people had an opportunity to vote on that last November, and at least in the Electoral College states, they voted and they believe with you. But I will say that this is the answer to a question I asked a little while ago. This is one of those issues that Donald Trump may have spoken about, but I don't expect President Trump to follow through on it. It's one area where you're going to be disappointed. On that note, we're going to pause for news. 1-800-723-8289. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Back in Chicago, we continue. We're going to talk about foreign policy right now, because last week there was also a lot of foreign policy related issues. Most notably, there was a conversation with the president of Mexico. There was a conversation with the prime minister of Australia. Comments later in the week about Israel and settlements. And Art Serier, our foreign policy expert here, has the press made too much of the conversation with the prime minister of Australia?
I think it's inherently news. I do believe there is a close and expanding alliance between President Trump and the media across the board, because he's constantly producing news. I think history indicates it's the most effective presidents have not been constantly talking. FDR did not make many fireside chats for a reason. But no, it's not. So you shouldn't criticize the news media for covering the news. The president and his blunt style is news.
One of the problems here, Doug, as a supporter of Donald Trump, aren't there too many leaks in this administration already?
Well, something happened. I don't know what the details are there, but it's actually fascinating. Once again, because of Donald Trump, Americans have educated themselves. We've learned. No one would have had occasion to educate themselves about how the Australians deal with refugees, and we found out some not so nice things about them, about their refugees. They call them boat people, actually, because people come over from the islands or whatnot, and they keep them off on some islands in very good conditions.
But
well, we also found out that there was another time bomb that Barack Obama planted. Apparently, there was basically a secret deal with the Obama administration and the Australians about these, what was it,
1,250 people?
Refugees. And I think Donald Trump was right to be upset about that.
But again, what about the leak? I mean, the point was that it was an abrupt phone call, and here was Donald Trump being abrasive to an ally. I mean, if you followed the campaign, why is it that the news media still is flabbergasted by some of his rhetoric, whether it's referring to a so-called federal judge or tweeting something? I mean, half of the discussions today on the Sunday shows were about, it was a so-called federal judge. You insulted the judge. That's what the guy is. He's 70 years old. He's not going to change.
The difference now is it's not just campaign rhetoric. It's official government policy. It's coming from, the head of our executive branch, and it has consequences.
But if he calls someone a so-called judge, tell me how that hurts the country.
Absolutely. We have a system of checks and balances. We have a system of separation of powers, which says that every branch of government is equal. And we're seeing the executive assert itself over the judicial branch. I'm going to point out something that's really petty, but just because a lot of people may not know it. But when Donald Trump redid the White House website, they removed the judicial branch from the directory of the menu. So it goes the Constitution, the executive branch, and Congress. There's no judicial branch there.
I don't even know if that's – I don't even know what the story is on that.
And I think it's just an example. When you say so-called judge, you're delegitimizing the judicial branch. And that's not something you can do. Now, you can be like Barack Obama, and Obama took heat for this when he called out the Supreme Court for its opinions, right? You can call out and say, I disagree with the court's reasoning and everything like that. When you start attacking judges in this political climate, it's not only obviously, you know, not in the spirit and faith of the Constitution, but you actually may be putting them in danger. There are people out there who view, you know, judicial activists as a target.
Wait a second.
And I think it's irresponsible of the president to be using that type of
language. Let me respond to that. Okay, so first of all, we heard earlier from our distinguished liberal guests that Democrats have no leaders. They are rudderless, leaderless. And by the way, as a Republican, I don't like to hear that because I think the country benefits from having a two-party system. I say that as a Republican in Chicago, where we don't have a two-party system. Everyone benefits when we have functioning two parties because Donald Trump can't do everything. I'm worried about these bad, spineless, weak Republicans backsliding, you know, on their own. So they do need a check. I'm all for that. But look, here's the problem. They wonder why they have no leaders. They wonder why they're not a national party anymore. And one reason why they were rejected so resoundingly in November is because they go hysterical over every little thing. This idea that President Trump is not, you know, is disrespecting the judicial branch is just nonsense.
What about the,
you know, this, I'll, look, I'll, this I'll, is, no wait, I'll answer the question. This judge, when he ignores Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the executive branch powers and as recognized by federal law and statute and court precedent.
I don't want to get into the weeds. I don't want to get into the weeds on this because what we have here is we have a judge in Washington who rules one way. We have a judge in Boston who rules a different way. So we're in the judicial system. My question to you is, in this particular case, maybe this is just another example of the news media, making a mountain out of a molehill.
Absolutely.
Because he had an abrupt conversation with one of our close allies.
Well, with respect to Australia,
the bigger issue. Barack Obama made a deal, whether it was secret or not, he made a deal to bring in 1,250 refugees. Donald Trump is now elected. He learns about this deal. I can't believe he certainly should have known about that deal before he got on the phone with the prime minister. We don't know whether that's a fact or not. The conversation was allegedly short. He said he didn't want him to send us any more Boston bombers. That sounds like a Donald Trump aside. It's not exactly great, but I understand his rhetoric. You're not going to change 70 years old guy. But but here's what happened. After all this brouhaha, Rex Tillerson gets sworn in as Secretary of State. And the bottom line of the story is the State Department is going to keep the deal that was made by Barack Obama.
Well, we don't know that. So that's what the State Department is saying.
That's the last story.
Exactly. That's what the State Department is saying. That's what the Prime Minister of Australia is saying. But remember, the Prime Minister of Australia came out and said, no, he agreed to accept the deal. And then shortly thereafter, I think it was a couple hours later, Donald Trump tweeted that he wasn't accepting the deal. So right now, we need clarity. And I think that's why it's a news story. Not because, you know, he has the bluster. And you're right. I mean, he's good for ratings. And it is a symbiotic relationship.
He's great for ratings. It's all about money,
sort.
Georgia.
It
it's all about money. We're
it
not talking about
though, especially when there's not clarity with respect to
but
policy.
But also, don't all political leaders, they play to their local base. The prime minister doesn't want to look like he's being pushed around by the president of the United States, just as the president of Mexico doesn't want to look like he's being pushed around by the president of the United States, and the president of the United States doesn't want to view like he's being pushed around by the Mexico. That's why they decided, hey, things were getting too hot too quickly. Hey, let's just cool it.
Donald Trump is advancing the ball in a positive way on so many fronts. I mean, and it's brilliant because the heads of all of his enemies are exploding. I mean, the press, the left. They can't deal with it. They've never had. These people are politicians. They mostly fail. They haven't been doing anything. Here we've got a business person. This is unique. We've never had a president who didn't come from either the political arena or from the military. This is a business guy who gets things done. He's advancing the ball all over the place. If the left wants to, you know, focus on just sit around and nitpick, that's fine. One quick thing, though, on this judicial thing.
We're going to break. I want you to come back and do it. The one thing I will say about being a businessman, because he is a businessman, I think there's a higher expectation that when he rolls out a program, like any good business, a lot of work, a lot of preparation had gone into it before it gets the rollout, it gets the launch to the general public. That's what I'm saying. And I think that's part of the criticism with the rollout of the immigration plan. Back shortly from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school. Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Georgia, you and Doug, you have both read the immigration ban, executive order. When you read it, what was the most egregious part of it for you personally?
I mean, clearly the fact that he's banning refugees from countries where, you know, we're the ones that are engaging in strikes. We're the ones that have dropped the ball a little bit on policy. These people are fleeing war, and there's been no evidence that a Syrian refugee that has come to the United States has engaged in any type of terrorist activity. I also found it to be unnecessarily limited. I mean, if you're going to embrace a Muslim ban like he promised on the campaign trail, and that was his words, right?
But he did back away from it. But he did back away from it. Would you acknowledge that?
Yes. And then you had Rudy Giuliani, though, go to the news shows. Rudy Giuliani obviously being a trusted advisor and say the president
but
came
not
to
part
me
of the administration.
Asking, yeah, not part of the administration, but he said the president came asking how to implement the Muslim ban legally, and this was our decision. In any event, you have these seven countries which are not part of the terrorists that attacked us on 9/11. They're not the ones that are feeding terrorists in terms of, you know, terrorist attacks in other countries. And yet he decided to ban these seven countries and the refugees that come from them. And I think when a court is going to look at it, it's going to say why these seven countries and not, you know, if you're, you know, reason for this order is really to clamp down on terrorism. Well, why not more?
Let's just answer the question. Seven countries. Let's focus on one part of this.
First of all, two of those seven countries are designated by the Obama administration, by the way, as state sponsors of terror, okay? Iran and Sudan. And the other five are plagued with terrorism. This is not a Muslim ban. This is a temporary suspension so that our government can, the Trump administration can get in there and see if we need any additional controls on our immigration policies, which is perfectly appropriate. And by the way,
let me just elaborate on that because I think it's important. The nations were selected by the Obama administration. They were confirmed basically by Congress. And the principal reason why that they were singled out was not so much that they had exported terrorism, although there had been some terrorism activities within the country. Those countries do not have the internal abilities, administrative abilities,
exactly,
to vet anyone.
Exactly.
That's why
they don't have record keeping that we would expect.
Okay. But here's my question to you, though. Okay, and I that makes sense to me why they would be on. Also, they are majority Muslim countries, but there are 42 other majority Muslim countries in the world, and they are not on the ban, including Saudi Arabia, including Pakistan, where we know there have been terrorists from those. Okay, so there's a difference there. But you know what? Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, they weren't on Barack Obama's list. Now, why were they not on Barack Obama's list? Do they not have the internal abilities to check and vet people like these other seven? I don't know about that. Do they have political influence in the United States? Yes, more so than these other seven. So there is a reason. It isn't, as the news media and some on the left have suggested, well, the reason they weren't on that is because Donald Trump has a hotel there.
No, I don't.
Now,
I
that's
don't,
not
yeah,
real.
I don't,
that's
I don't buy that.
They're
yeah.
also very insecure countries.
Which
there's
ones?
Not the two that you singled out,
yes.
Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. There's not really a Saudi or a Pakistan lobby. I think what you're really getting at is they're very vulnerable. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. They're extremely
yes.
important to the United States, and we did not want to antagonize either one.
Right.
Where fundamentalism is very strong. If we lost either one, that would be serious. Nuclear weapons on the one hand and a lot of oil on the other.
Why doesn't someone just say that? Because it seems to me in the first
I just said it, Bruce.
But I mean, last Sunday on all the shows, all the media experts on the show, they were all saying, well, why don't you have these two in there? Why don't you have the, and it was they, the left and some of those in the media, they wanted more countries put it
out. Well,
they
were just pointing out. They were just pointing out the fact that, you know, and it's not just those two countries, right?
Right.
If the whole thrust of your policy is I'm going to shut down the refugee program so we don't allow terrorists in, right? The way that he did it is not the way it works. Anybody who's done any type of refugee work, and in my day job, obviously, I follow quite a bit what's happening mm-hmm. with the refugee crisis. When you have 2 million refugees in Turkey alone, do you know how easy it is for those refugees just to get a new passport and jump on a plane and come here?
Well,
and they're from
Donald
Iraq.
They're
from Iran. They're from Syria. But Turkey is not on the immigration ban. They can do the same thing in Europe. A refugee can jump, you know, get fake documents, jump on a plane to Germany,
so here's
fly
my,
in from Germany.
Georgia,
so,
here's my question to you then. Would you advocate that these other countries that you've just articulately laid out to the audience, would you argue that they should be on, that they should join the list of these other
absolutely
seven countries?
Absolutely not, because it's, you know what? This idea that there didn't exist extreme vetting is an absolute lie. The refugee vetting program takes a, it's years-long process. It's absolutely in conjunction with the United Nations and a whole bunch of, you know, intelligence agency. So this idea that we were just letting people in an open door without vetting them is absolutely false.
Here's the big difference. Here's what that judge in Seattle, the one that put a halt, at least for now, on the Donald Trump's executive order. That federal judge in Seattle is not getting a copy of the security briefings, the national security briefings that our President of the United States does. And people here who are not experts or not involved in this, who are not getting those security briefings, cannot second guess about which countries should be on there. But we do know that two of them are state sponsors of terror, and the other ones have major problems with terrorism.
Let me ask you for another. Would you also acknowledge that one of the countries on that list is Iraq? We have we are in Iraq. We have Iraqis now fighting a war against ISIS with ourselves. They are our allies at the moment. So if you are from Iraq and you're fighting for your own country, but you're fighting alongside Americans against ISIS, do you think that some people there might be upset that the country you're helping fight for won't let your relatives in the United States of America?
No, that's not letting us. First of all, there's a temporary ban, and that executive order makes it very clear that there are on a case-by-case basis, we're still looking there.
But answer my question. Realistically, Doug, let's talk about...
I'm upset when I go to the post office and it takes me 2 hours to mail a package. Any government policy or initiative is going to require some frustration. The Constitution does not guarantee anyone, and certainly not a foreign national, the right to be free of any inconvenience.
Art,
what?
My point about Iraq.
Yeah.
Should Iraq be on that list?
I don't think it was wise, the whole order, but you make a very good point about Iraq. Iraq is not actually a country. Sudan is not actually a country. They're a complete mess. In the case of Iraq, it's because of the American attack and invasion and occupation. No, I think it's a very unwise approach.
If I can just add about the order, you know, you're completely right that the judge maybe currently doesn't have the intelligence available to him, and injunctive relief is not based on all of the evidence, obviously. Anybody who's an attorney knows injunctive relief is based on whether there's, you know, immediate irreparable mm-hmm. harm. But here's my question for the people that support Donald Trump and his policies and his attacks on the executive branch. When this does go to the evidentiary phase, absolutely the judge is going to have access to intelligence, and it's going to be in camera, obviously reviewed. It's not going to be part of the public record. But judges always get, you know, the government side of the case, and they're privy to information that the general public is not. If that judge, upon reviewing the evidence, upon reviewing the totality of the government's case, still rules that the ban is unconstitutional, will Donald Trump supporters recognize the legitimacy of that decision?
You're talking about hypotheticals, but first of all, this judge is already. I read his order. It was only 7 pages, most of which was background. Never even explained how. Actually, he didn't even use the word unconstitutional. Never explained or even attempted to explain how this executive order was unconstitutional. That executive order. Here's what a lot of people probably don't realize. It specifically calls for. Specifically anticipates that in 2017. The United States will accept 50,000 refugees. That is actually more than during many years of the George W. Bush administration, and it was about the same number that were accepted during the Obama administration until his huge increase in 2016. I'm sorry that it is unfortunate for the people in the Middle East that the horribly incompetent policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton created so many refugees. That is tragic.
If I may, real quick, because I've heard this a lot on the right, you know, attacking the judge because of the length of his order. It was only 7 pages and it was only a couple paragraphs. The Office of Legal Counsel that signed off and blessed President Trump's order, their determination was 11 words long.
That's
it says we have reviewed. They said
opinion.
It was the acting Attorney General of the United States that said we have reviewed the proposed order and find it was correct in process and legality.
I want to ask Art a question.
Okay.
This came up during the campaign. The president alluded to it last week, and that is to have a safe zone. Instead of bringing refugees to Europe and to the United States and to Australia, that a safe zone be created for that region of the world that would be protected by the United States, built by the United States, maybe with involvement, money from Middle Eastern nations, including Saudi Arabia. Conceptually, does that work? Would that work?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Conceptually, you can think it up. Well, we sponsor teachers' institutes with the Foreign Policy Research Institute and often the First Division Museum out in Wheaton. Excuse me. They often deal with military topics.
I'm going to get you some more water.
An armored officer, retired colonel with 2 combat tours in Iraq, now working for RAND, whose name I won't mention, made a very strong and sensible case that they're impractical in the reality of fluid combat and unconventional warfare and terrorists. I believe the idea originated with the Clinton campaign, which was very heavy on academic advisors like me. So I'm very skeptical. I'm very, unless there's an extraordinarily good reason outside of special operations, I don't think we should have any more U.S. forces on the ground there.
So no camps, no safe zone.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, that's the question. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Your calls. When we roll on from Chicago, thanks for joining us tonight.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up with the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. First of all, back in Chicago, one of the things that obviously wherever the president goes, he makes news. Wherever he tweets, he can make the news. He can change the subject anytime. Today he did a halftime interview during the Super Bowl with Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. And who knows what else was included in that interview. Perhaps you're listening out there in radio and TV land. You can tell us because we're opposite it right now, so we don't know exactly what he said. But the big story, according to the advance that came out, was there was a conversation Bill O'Reilly was talking to him about Vladimir Putin and his relationships with Vladimir Putin. And Donald Trump, in response, had this to say. Trump. I do not respect him, but I respect, I do respect him. I do respect him, but I respect a lot of people. That doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. Then Bill O'Reilly asks, but Putin is a killer, to which the president responds, there are a lot of killers. We've got a lot of killers. What do you think? Our country's so innocent? Doug, the news media has gone apoplectic with that response. So have some Democrats. Your response to what you think he meant?
Well, he's not going to point fingers at any Americans, but I mean, come on, let's not be naive. I mean, are we really going to say that the CIA, we've never targeted anyone or we've never killed? Remember in 98 when we had that wag the dog situation with President Clinton, and he was trying to take distract everyone, and he did an airstrike in Sudan and blew up an aspirin factory. I mean, the left is so, I mean, these crocodile tears. Oh, it's so crazy, but yet embrace this murderous. Talk about that. I mean, the Castro's in Cuba. I mean, murderous regime? Trump's got to work with these people. Trump has to work with Russia, and I know the left wants a ground war with Russia because they think that Putin helped expose how incredibly corrupt Hillary was. But we have, as the professor very adroitly said earlier, we have common interests with Russia, and we have the common enemy of radical Islam and ISIS.
My question to you, as our progressive. This comment today by the president, there's probably a lot of leftists who agree with what the president said today.
I don't think so. I mean, look, there's a difference between, the segment of the left that has criticized American foreign policy, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between what Donald Trump has done, which, shocked a lot of people, not just the media, not just progressives. You have Republican congressmen speaking out against it. You have Republicans that are shocked by this statement because you have a president who claims to be always pounding his chest and saying America first. And he's had multiple opportunities to point out the fact that America is morally superior to Russia, and he has refused to do so. The big difference between us, of course, is Putin goes out and kills his political opponents. We don't do that in the United States. And the fact that our president refuses to call him out on that is extremely disturbing.
But wait a second, Georgia. I thought the left used to love Russia when it was, the Soviet Union before the breakup. They used to love the Soviet Union when it was actually more brutal and more repressive.
So you're pointing out that Russia is brutal and repressive, it's gotten only worse since
I just think it hasn't. They killed a lot more people. They killed a lot more people when your side loved them, but now that they've actually become kind of sorted democratic, what you guys hate is that you guys have got in your mind that your corrupt candidate lost because Putin had something
Russia
because
again, Putin and making it about Hillary Clinton.
You guys hate Russia. You want to go to another war,
What do you want?
Okay, back to your corners, Professor. After the Cold War is a book that you wrote many years ago. My question to you is, when we look at the relationship between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, he says they don't know each other. Your reaction to this quote, first of all.
I think the president shouldn't speak so much and so informally. That's why presidents traditionally don't. Putin's a KGB killer who made his bones in East Germany, which was the most totalitarian state, perhaps. Built on top of the Gestapo, it may have been the most brutal police state in history outside of maybe North Korea.
What should young people listening to this show, including myself, we're going to go back with this question. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of Americans that are very concerned about the relationship between this president and Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the relationship between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin. What was that relationship like?
It was a very complicated working relationship. It was essential during the Second World War. Roosevelt and, don't forget, Winston Churchill and Stalin worked very effectively together to destroy the Third Reich.
Is it safe to suggest that maybe in this world that we live in today, where ISIS is the problem, much more so than the Nazis were in the late 30s, mm-hmm. that the United States and Russia and maybe other nations of the world could get together to defeat ISIS, and that all of these, that many of these countries that may despise one another, and they're made up of people who are murderers and killers and rapists, and you name them, that they can all get together for the good of killing ISIS and killing it off.
Yes, I believe I alluded to that cooperation in the Middle East, actual and potential, early in the program. Stalin was a very, very tough negotiator, and of course immoral and a mass murderer and all the other. But he
far
always,
worse than Putin.
If I may finish the point, sir, he always stuck with his agreements. He always stuck with his agreements. Putin doesn't have such a good track record, which is something to keep in mind. The analogy is great. I'm always glad when you mention history. We also are not, thank God, involved in a total world war, a total war which we could have lost.
But
therefore, when, the stakes are lower, but he doesn't seem to be as reliable as, ironically, Joseph Stalin was.
But when they all got together at Yalta, they basically divided up the world, right? Those three men divided up the world?
Not really. No, I think that's an overstatement.
What did they do at Yalta?
They confirmed post-war occupation agreements for Germany.
Can there be, in this time, with Vladimir Putin being one person at that table, Donald Trump being another person at that table, maybe Prime Minister May being another person at that table, and maybe having a couple of other seats open at that table?
Don't forget Germany.
And Germany. Angela Merkel.
Today.
At that table.
Right.
Could they get together today and decide what the future of the Middle East is going to look like post-ISIS, if indeed the goal is to get rid of ISIS? Could they divide up the Middle East?
No.
This contemporary time?
I don't think so. For one thing, we have the United Nations, which is an effective international body with many, many shortcomings and limitations. That was not a reality during World War II. That's the way the Allies described themselves. These countries have quite variable national interests, and that's unavoidable, and we're not involved in a total war. The Russians are effectively asserting primary, I believe, diplomatic and military leadership in the Middle East today.
Does the free world, do they have to get involved in a focused war against ISIS? You say we're not in a war today.
Well, we
can,
sure.
No,
I said we're not in a total war today.
Total war.
Sure, we're in a...
Does there need to be a total war against ISIS?
To obliterate it, yes, but we don't need a total world war to do that.
Okay.
It's already deteriorating. There is good news in that
so
area.
President Trump's pledge to wipe ISIS off the face of the earth, do you think that's a promise that can be delivered on?
Not unilaterally by the United States, nor do I think. I think it's counterproductive when we put large numbers of our forces on the ground.
But I think that's what's great about Trump. I think he has the, you know, just through force of personality, and because he is such a good negotiator, and that's what he's been talking about, same thing with NATO, but I think he's going to finally get some of these other Middle Eastern countries who have the most at stake here to actually step up and do, you know, carry their weight.
Do you believe at this moment, Doug, do you believe that the United States should lift its sanctions and the rest of the world, that they should lift their sanctions against Russia for their involvement in...
Oh, my goodness. There's so much I don't know about that. I wouldn't pretend to be an expert in that area. I don't know.
They are paying a price. Should they pay a stiffer price? Should they pay a price for their alleged involvement in our campaign?
I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on that. There's a lot of moving balls here, but I will say in defense of Donald Trump, just what I do know on this, I think Bill O'Reilly is actually a very fair interviewer. I think he's fair, and I think he didn't want to come across as being favorable to Trump. But I do think that was a bit of a gotcha question. So what do you do? You're on national television, huge audience before the Super Bowl, and O'Reilly was, I mean, shame on him. I think he was looking for sort of a Donald Trump, the President of the United States, to say that, you know, Vladimir Putin is a killer. And I don't think that was a fair question. I don't think it gets us anywhere because we've been talking. We do have some common interests. Look, imagine the irony here. So we got all these angry millennials are on their handheld devices, and they're saying, oh, this is so terrible. And they're on a handheld device is probably made in China, which has a terrible human rights record. I mean, how many? We don't even know how many were killed after Tiananmen Square.
Well,
of thousands.
Okay, but here's my question, whether this is a gotcha question or not. How would you describe Vladimir Putin?
He's a tough guy, but we have some common interests.
Is killer an appropriate word?
I don't know. I'm not here to defend Vladimir Putin. He's a tough guy. I saw the Frontline documentary on him. I've read about him. I think he led the KGB. You don't get that position by being a Sunday school teacher.
No, I'm saying
we know that.
The simple answer to the question is yes, he's a killer. We got to pause back shortly.
He probably is.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Back in Chicago, thanks very much for joining us. Let's talk about again the news media, and this gets into the Putin conversation. Do you believe, Georgia, the story? How much do you believe that that Russia was involved in trying to screw up this election?
I'm not the expert. I trust our intelligence agencies, all of which have come to the conclusion that there was a concerted effort by the Russian led by the Russian government to influence the election. There were databases that were hacked at the state level, but there's zero evidence publicly that they actually affected vote total. So I'm not going to say that Donald Trump didn't win the votes that he did. He lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, but I'm not going to deny him a single vote that was validly cast for him.
Do you believe the stories of that the Russians allegedly had sexually explicit video about Donald Trump, which has made it to the public?
I'm not going to believe a story based off of one unverified document, right? And I think that's why so many members of Congress
have called. But BuzzFeed did.
BuzzFeed actually, when they put it out, they said this is unverified, it contains errors. They put all of these disclaimers out, but they did put it out. And I think it raised questions.
Why did they do it, do you think?
Well, for traffic, right? I mean, every news site lives off of traffic. And I think it also bothered them that news organizations had this document during the campaign. They also had information that the FBI was investigating. And this to me is far more important than that dossier, which is, you know, unverified and everything like that. You had an FBI investigation into contacts by the Trump campaign with members of the Russian government and exchanges of information. The FBI knew that that was happening. They chose not to make any public statements about that. In fact, they actually denied it and falsely denied it to the New York Times. But they chose to send a letter out 2 weeks before the election regarding a non-story with Hillary Clinton. I think that's why members of Congress are saying, you know what, we're not trying to rehash the election. We're not trying to say Donald Trump is illegitimate. But we need to, for the sake of our electoral process, investigate the security of our systems and whether or not Russia did try to influence the election.
Here is why. Let me just offer a comment. I want to get Art's response to this as well. The reason why I don't believe the salacious sex tape involving Donald Trump allegedly, purportedly in the hands of the Russians is real, because in this day and age, if such a video existed, it would have been all over the Internet. Because of the clicks that Georgia was just referencing. So the fact that a website decides that they're going to use that in a very titillating way, Art, what does that do to the discussion of separating real news from fake news, because that was, in my view, that was fake news that was reported, albeit by a website, but then it got picked up by the mainstream media.
Well, that's the world in which we live. It's, if it's fake news, why are you and I discussing it with our two colleagues here this evening? It's old news, no, Bruce. Why are we bringing up this salacious, dirty story?
The question is that it made it to the mainstream media.
Yeah,
and
well,
people are reacting to
you're
it.
You're reconfirming that. It's old news. Well, Why should we be discussing it? My own personal view is Trump is not that stupid. Everybody knows that the Soviets use Russians use sex.
Well, let's face what we call so-called mainstream media. Let's face it, a lot of these folks were really, they're not really journalists. They were involved basically working for a failed Hillary Clinton super PAC. They were completely in the tank. Bias doesn't even do it justice. They were corrupt and dishonest. So it's an echo chamber, like you said. So BuzzFeed puts it out, and then some other dishonest reporters can say, "Oh well, we're not vouching for this, but it's out there. It's just nonsense." Just like the Democratic Party, I thought given how embarrassed and defeated the press was that they would, get their act together, go back and regroup. But they're not. I mean, they're just...
I can correct the record real quick.
I think they're just... They're marginalizing themselves more every day.
CNN was the first to confirm the story, and they did not even talk about any of the salacious stuff.
That's correct.
So what story?
The only thing that they mentioned was that there was a document that was appended to an intelligence briefing that was provided to Donald Trump that referenced... certain allegations regarding Russia. They were extremely cautious in the way that they reported. And the newsworthiness to them was, hey, there was something about Russia appended, Russia and Donald Trump's campaign appended to an intelligence briefing.
But didn't they say potential blackmail?
BuzzFeed jumped in.
A personal nature?
BuzzFeed jumped in and posted the entire document, which is what BuzzFeed does, right? I mean, they're all about the clicks. And they, said and laid out their reasons as well. But again, I mean, you pointed it out. It's a salacious story. We shouldn't be talking about the details. What we should be talking about is the actual confirmed, verified news that there are current investigations and FISA court warrants.
By who? Investigations by the Hillary administration? By the Obama administration?
The United States government went to the FISA intelligence court and requested warrants against Carter Page
and a couple
other
people. The
reason why we need an investigation is because we have people saying fake news, fake news. If we can't even trust the fact that there needs to be an investigation so we can find the truth.
Just stop it. The idea that
it was okay to do it during Benghazi and have $1 million hearings based on it, when the integrity of our democracy is at stake,
wait a
people
second.
Want
you know,
to be
this
silent.
This is so ridiculous. The idea, yes, the left was so concerned about cybersecurity and the Russians hacking, they backed to the hilt a candidate who put a confidential top secret information on her personal server at home.
Again, this is not about
nonsense.
The hacking.
This is why you guys
lost. This shows me that you did not research the issue
lost.
Properly. There were members of Donald Trump's campaign.
You're not serious.
This has nothing to do with hacking. There is confirmed reports, and it's not the liberal media. It's not New York Times. This is Wall Street Journal. This is institutions on the right that have confirmed the story. This has nothing to do with hacking or emails, but members of Donald Trump's campaign were being investigated by the United States government during the campaign for contacts and communications with the Russian government.
The questions, if the investigations are going on, we will have the result of that at some point. But right now we don't. It's all speculation. I'm just saying is that BuzzFeed, obviously they got their clicks. Mm-hmm. They got their news coverage. But in doing so, I think they poisoned the well in a variety of different ways. When that story suddenly ends up as the lead of the following Saturday Night Live, where there's a whole skit of one of the most offensive skits I've ever heard on Saturday Night Live, or seen on Saturday Night Live, basically picking up a rumor that's totally false about the president-elect of the United States. I think it's a disservice. It plays into the belief that a lot of people have in this country. You can't believe the mainstream media. And that story is not going to go away. We are out of time. Thank you all for being with us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as